We're taking a look at your pet's health today here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Great to have back Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. And one of the things, whether you know it or not, relating to your pet's health, especially your dog's health, is the leash that you use. So we'll talk about leashes. We'll also touch on ticks and dental care and, of course, answer your pet care questions at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post a photo, a pet photo and question on our Facebook page titled The Larry Mueller Show. Dr. Sandy, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's nice to be back.
Well, lots of different kinds of leashes out there.
Mm-hmm.
Some are much better than others.
We actually, at our clinic, see a lot of dogs coming in with being on the flexi leads or the retractable leads. And there are some pet stores that have actually banned them, not allowing people to come into the pet store, and yet they continue to sell them. These are these leads that have the big bulky handle and the thin cord that runs down to your dog, and some of them can extend out to about 26 feet, I think is about the maximum I've seen. And the reason why I wanted to bring this up is a friend of mine just had a very serious accident with her dog as a result of being on one of these flexi leads. She was walking last weekend when the weather was beautiful on a hiking trail in her local community, and the dog was out at the end of its leash. The dog is a small terrier type dog, and got up and around the corner, and there was another dog approaching that a child was walking that was able to break away from the child and attacked and came very close to killing her dog. She did not have enough time to be able to retract the leash, get the dog back in, lift the dog up, get the dog away. And in that period of time that she walked, though, that 26 feet to be able to get to her dog, it was already very, very damaged. And I think that what I like to say is, what my technician says, is that it gives the owner the illusion of control of their dog. They really don't have any control. And I can give you all kinds of incidents of, I've had owners that have been pulled down the stairs because the brake wasn't on and the dog managed to get up to full speed. You can imagine in 26 feet how fast a dog can be going, and pulled this elderly woman down the stairs where she fractured her leg. I've had dogs killed because they were suddenly startled. They were at the end of their leash and run out into the road. I've had owners that have had pretty severe injuries to themselves because they've been wrapped up in the cord. Not personally anybody that I know, but in the news, even things as far as finger amputations, because of the fact that that cord is so thin, those cords break and snap back. And I almost took an owner's eye out the other day. They were in the exam room with their dog on a flexi lead, and I like to have the dogs off leash so they can roam around and I can talk to the owner. It gets the dog feeling a little more comfortable. And I just made this assumption that the leash was on a break because he'd been out in the waiting room, and you really have to have the dogs on short leashes out there so they're not interacting. But it wasn't. And I unhooked it from the dog, let go of it, and this thing zipped back with the spring-loaded action in the handle and flipped up and hit the owner in the face. And I came so close to taking out that owner's eye, and I felt so bad because it would have been a very simple thing to prevent if that I had known that the spring was still loaded and it wasn't going to just sit still there. So lots of things happen. I think if you're going to be buying your dog a leash, get them the standard 6-foot-long leash. They even make some that have shorter handles built in the middle so that if you need to suddenly make your dog on like a 3-foot leash, you've got another handle built in. Those are great for dogs that you may not have a lot of control over. But it all comes down to, if you're going to be taking your dog out in public, you need to have good control, not only for your liability. Your dog may hurt someone else. Happened to my dog a couple of years ago. My dog Pete got attacked by Two dogs that were on flexi leads while a fellow was rollerblading in the street, and they managed to get over on the sidewalk and attack him. He ended up in the emergency room with drains in and so on. But it's so it always happens, and so I've got my personal things, but I think it's just in general, put those away. Don't buy them. Don't give them to people. If you've got one, throw it out. Get a 6-foot leash and walk your dog and give it all the exercise it needs with 6 feet away from you.
Probably cheaper, too.
Oh, yeah.
I think it'd be a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
So there's the advice. What about ticks now? We got ticks out there already?
Yeah, and I think people tend to confuse flea weather and heartworm season with tick season. And my kind of pat saying that I give to my students and owners is that you do not need 365 days of tick control, but you do need 12 months of tick control. All right. And what I mean by that is that, yes, we have had a few days ago snow. Now we've got weather in the 40s. You know, deer ticks love that upper, like mid-30s to 40-degree weather. And so we've been getting pets in the last month with ticks. And it may only be a day or two, but remember, they're not hibernating. They're just waiting for that weather to warm up enough so that they can crawl about 18 inches up on various sticks and grass blades and so on, and quest, which is where they hold on with their back legs and put their front legs out. And as soon as something walks by, brushes by, they will glob on, and they hope it's going to be somebody that can provide them with a meal. And unfortunately, it could be your dog. So if you don't have your dogs on flea and cats, even though cats typically don't get many of the tick diseases that dogs do, I think both dogs and cats, if the cats are going outside, should be on tick control, which means they're going to be on flea control as well. And I've even been diagnosing a few flea cases recently. I think they probably were ones that have been kind of hanging around since the fall and are in the owner's houses.
Yeah.
I had one family just recently that moved into a new apartment building, and guess what their surprise was?
Oh, fleas.
And so I couldn't believe that their pet had fleas because it's a strictly indoor pet. Well, somebody left them behind. So flea and tick control year round for your dogs and cats.
Well, I want to talk with you about dental care too, but maybe that'll turn up in some of our questions. Let's go to Jill in Appleton, find out what's on her mind. Hi, Jill.
Hi.
What can we do for you today?
Okay, so we have a Boston Terrier that's been our family pet, and he's been just about 8 years old. And he is a white-faced Boston, so his coloring doesn't go over his eyes, which my question for you is, you know, when he was really little, we didn't have any tear staining. And as he's gotten older, it seems as though the drainage from his eyes and even around the corners of his mouth a little bit has that dark brown kind of staining, and kind of gets clumpy even. And we have, you know, when we bathe them, we got to really scrub that area to get that off. And it seems like, you know, it ebbs and flows with how bad it gets, depending on the season and so on. But is there anything we can do to help prevent it from coming?
Well, the first thing we always get concerned about is, why is your dog excessively tearing? That brown staining is due to chemicals in the tears and saliva that react with light and turn that kind of rusty brown color. And that's why when I have a dog that comes in that is allergic, I can tell because I look at their, especially if it's a white dog, I can look at their feet and say, you've been licking your feet. And even if the owner says, I've never seen them lick their feet, it's like, they're brown. They've been licking their feet. So that's why you've got it around your dog's mouth. But Boston Terriers being a brachycephalic breed, meaning one of those short faced dogs, are more prone to ocular trauma and eye diseases than some of the other breeds that we have out there. And it's just because their eyes are right out there in the middle of the world for everything to touch them and irritate them. Right. And so some things that I would be recommending, number one would be, make sure that you have your veterinarian do a thorough eye exam, making sure that your dog is producing enough tears. sometimes, especially if the stuff is kind of goopy, more material, sometimes as dogs get older, their eyes get dry, just like with people, and they need to be on treatment to help them with making tears. I'd also make sure that there isn't any hair or anything rubbing on your dog's eyes. Dogs with a lot of face folds and things, or the hairy push face dogs like Shih Tzus and, you know, some of the Maltese and Yorkies will have a lot of hair from their face actually touching their eyes. And you can imagine what that would be like. You'd be tearing all the time. And so keeping your dog groomed, making sure that there isn't hair there, or aberrant hairs growing. We'll sometimes see dogs sprouting hair from the edge of their eyelids, and it's a weird spot to get it. But imagine if we had an eyelash that instead of curling out, went straight down and was rubbing on our cornea all the time. And we see that very commonly, and they don't have to be born with it. It's something that we can see develop later in life. And so I think a good eye exam where they're checking tear production, they're staining the eyes to make sure that there isn't any corneal damage, they're making sure that there's no inflammatory changes in the eye, and then the fact that you're seeing it be a seasonal thing, there may be a little bit of an allergy component going on as well, and some of these dogs need to be on topical medications to make them feel more comfortable during allergy season. So there's lots of things that we can do to get to the bottom of it, but the brown staining is just the tip of the iceberg. And if you clear up the tearing, the brown staining will eventually go away. But there are products on the market that supposedly can help get rid of some of that staining, that are, you know, cleaning agents, drying agents, but you got to use them all the time. They're not very effective, and it's more, let's figure out why the tearing is happening in the first place.
There we go. Thanks so much for calling, Joe. Appreciate your call. I want to give Randy in Green Bay a chance to join us. Randy, hello.
Hello, how are you today?
Great, appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Okay, I have an orange male tabby cat who's about 13 and a third years old. And I noticed this past Saturday, and he has normally greenish to yellowish irises, but on the right eye, the iris became brown.
Mm.
The entire iris is entirely brown. It's not outside the iris. He's not tearing. He's not no discharge from it. His pupil on his left eye looks about the same size as on the right eye.
Good, good.
And I was just wondering what could be possibly causing this. I mean, he's not slowed down with his activity. He's eating is good. His drinking is good. His bathroom activities are good.
And it's still brown, right?
Yeah. We see this.
Brown.
Yeah, we see this happen, and there's actually two things that can happen to the iris. The fact that the pupils are the same, that his eye is comfortable, I would think that it's probably not an inflammatory change inside the eye that could be triggering something like this, something called uveitis, which is inflammation in the front part of the eye. But there is a condition that we see. There's actually two conditions that we see that can affect the iris in senior cats. One of them is called iris melanosis, which just means they get kind of pigment spots on their iris that are benign and they don't change. And so when we get a kitty in that we first start seeing some pigment change in the iris, we usually take a digital picture and put it in the pet's record so that we can track it on subsequent visits. There's another condition, though, that we see that's more concerning, and that's called iris melanoma. And just like in humans, melanoma is, you know, is a malignant tumor. In cats, it can be as well. Fortunately, when it occurs in the eye, they tend to metastasize very slowly. And that's why when we have a cat that initially starts getting some pigment change, we just sit back and watch to see what's going to happen. If the, you know, if it's spreading, then we get more concerned that this may be an iris melanoma. And really the only treatment for it, and I would be recommending that you see your veterinarian for this or maybe a veterinary ophthalmologist, is to enucleate the eye, meaning taking the eye out. There is really no cure for it, but caught early, before it's had a chance to spread, that is curative. And that's why we wait and watch these things, because we don't want to be removing eyes from an animal that has a benign process going on. And it's not until we sit back and watch it for several months to sometimes a couple of years before we have an idea what we may be dealing with. So I'm sorry to break that.
The entire iris is all brown.
Yeah.
It's not like it's spots.
Yeah, and that makes me think that this is an iris melanoma, that it's spread and it's changed color. And I think that...
Within a day?
Well, no. I mean, some owners just don't notice it, and so I don't want to say that that's your case, but I think then that there may be, if it went that quickly, there may be some indication that there may be some inflammatory change or something else going on in your cat's eye, and that needs to be evaluated. So getting your cat in to either your veterinarian or an ophthalmologist is going to be the best bet for your cat, because the worst case is that it could be something like a very fast-growing melanoma.
Hmm.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, thanks for calling, Randy. And, boy, there's a beautiful photo up on our Facebook page. Jan sent a photo of her rescued Cocker Spaniel.
Oh, he's beautiful.
Oh, what, yeah. What a look on his face.
I know.
I love it. Well, thanks, Jan, for sending that along. You can send one to us as well. We'd love to see your photo of your kitty or your dog or any of your pets. Send that to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical instructor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 1 o'clock today on the Kathleen Dunn Show, you will find out why millennials aren't interested in running for office and what that may mean for our future. Right now, taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. 1-800-642-1234, the number to call. Send your photo and question on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to see that as well. Jeanette in Denmark has a question for us, Sandy. Let's go there. Jeanette, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm so glad to talk to you. This is a problem that has... been going on for about 2 years with my cat, who's about 10 years old. So I'd like to know if you can either confirm what we've been doing or maybe shed some new light on it. She started scratching. She's itchy. And, of course, we've had her to the vet, and we've tried different things. Presently, we've got her on gluten-free food, and, of course, she's got all the flea and tick stuff, and they've checked her ears for mites and whatnot. And the only thing that helps her is we have to keep her on a steroid. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts on a situation like this or why a cat gets an allergy when they're older.
We do see it happen, and it can potentially be food. And if you caught me, if there was a camera looking at me, you probably saw me smirk when you said gluten-free. That is a human fad, and there's only one breed that we see, and it's Irish setters have some issues with gluten intolerance, but it's very rare. And so having them on a gluten-free diet, again, it's just kind of following the human trend, which I'm not going to go there because I'm not in the human medical field. But when we do see animals that develop food allergies later in life, and it can be something that they've been eating for a long time. It's usually the protein source that they become allergic to. It's chicken, beef, seafood, those types of things. And so where we are at right now with trying to diagnose food allergies is that because so many cats have been exposed to just about every type of protein out there, we really have to go to specialized diets that are hydrolyzed protein, meaning broken down into tiny bits where the body doesn't recognize where it came from. And there are some therapeutic diets out there that are better than others. You are not going to be able to get a diet over the counter because all of the diets that you can get at pet stores, even though they may say limited antigen, meaning limited protein, maybe one type of protein, they're made in plants that aren't totally cleaned out from other batches. And so they're almost always contaminated. And so for a dietary trial, we need to have the cat for a good 2 to 3 months on this hydrolyzed protein diet. The one that our clinic recommends is one that is made by a pet food company called Royal Canin. There are some that are out there. The Nestle Purina company makes them. Hill's makes one as well. But that is the one that they recommend because they find that it has virtually like no contamination at all. They can guarantee that if you're going to do a food trial, that's the food that's going to work. So that would be the one that I would be recommending that your veterinarian get you a prescription for and that you try. The long-term steroid use is can really be a problem for the cat. One, it thins the skin. It predisposes them to infections. It predisposes them to developing diabetes. It can weaken their cartilage, and we'll actually see these cats come in looking like a Scottish fold cat that have the weak cartilage in their ear and their ears flopped over. We call it steroid ears. And so there's a lot of risks involved. And so if your cat needs to be on something to control the itching, and, you know, a short bout of steroids isn't helping, then we look into things that we can use safer, like cyclosporine for a cat is something that we use frequently when we have cats that we have diagnosed with having allergies. I'm so glad that your veterinarian, even if your cat is strictly indoors, is doing the flea and tick treatment. But one other thing that you may want to try to get off the table as well is there's a parasite that is contagious from cat to cat, and some cats are more susceptible to serious symptoms than others, and it's given the name Demodex. And unfortunately, there isn't a really good treatment that we can use in cats to get rid of it, except this product called Lyme Sulfur Dip. And we have to use it over several weeks. It smells like rotten eggs. It's not fun, but that is a very effective way of clearing some of these cats from this particular parasite called Demodex. So if the lifestyle of your cat indicates that they've been around stray cats, you've introduced another cat, and that's part of the history, then I would be wanting to get that off the table as well.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Good luck. Lots to think about there, Jeanette.
Yeah.
Appreciate your call very much. Mary in Rock Falls has something else to talk about. Let's go there. Hi, Mary.
I think it's Harry.
Oh, Harry. Sorry.
Excellent. Yeah, thanks.
What can we do for you, Harry?
We have a 5-year-old pocket pit bull, and she has been losing her toenails from the root lately. We've had her to the vet. She says that it may be an autoimmune thing, and so we're on like a decreasing steroid and then an antibiotic and a fungicide. And I just wondered what you might think. They just fall off, and then the quick is left, and they've been growing back. But
and that, I think your veterinarian has hit it right on the head with what this may be.
Yeah.
And it is not that common, but there was a year ago I had a month where I had like 3 dogs in a row come in that had this. And what you'll see is like they just start getting their nails get brittle, and they may look normal, but then they start breaking more easily. And it's I'm drawing a blank on the name of it. I think it's called onychodystrophy, something like that. But I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact name of it because dermatology likes to come up with all kinds of weird names for their diseases. But the things that we will treat them with besides steroids is sometimes we'll have these dogs on a combination of other things that are immune modulating drugs. We'll sometimes use a tetracycline type drug and another drug called niacinamide in combination. Sometimes high doses of vitamin E help these dogs. But it often comes down to just frequent nail trims, wearing booties when they're outside for protection. We rarely can get them to be totally back to normal, but we can manage them and make them more comfortable. So if the steroids are not cutting it, start looking into some of these other immune modulating drugs that we can use very, very safely for dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right, something to think about. Thanks, Harry. Kay in Wisconsin Dells, on to you now. Hi, Kay.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about the Lyme disease vaccine. I get one for my dog every year. We live in the country, and there are certainly ticks around. And is it worthwhile? Does it?
That's a very good question. I think the best way of preventing tick-borne diseases, and remember, we have many more tick-borne diseases in our state than just Lyme disease. We have anaplasma and ehrlichia, and there's some that we probably don't even know about that ticks can be carrying. So I think it's extremely important to practice, as I said earlier in the show, year-round tick control. Some of my favorite things that work very well are the newer oral products that are out there. There's one that lasts for 3 months called Brevecto, and there's two that last for a month, NexGard and Simparica. Nice and easy to use, nothing to wash off the dog, no human contact risk. There's a collar called the Seresto collar that works very well. And then there's also all the spot-on products like Frontline and Advantix and so on that are also relatively effective. So those would be things to figure out kind of what your veterinarian likes to use in your area and stick with it year round. When we have a dog that is even on year-round tick control, there's always that chance that there could be a break and the dog could be exposed. And so, again, if you're in a heavy tick area, the Lyme vaccine would be something that you might want to consider having given to your dog. It is not a vaccine that is 100% effective, but it's pretty darn good. And I think that we're seeing it compared to what we had available in the 90s, in the last 20 years, the changes and developments in making safer Lyme vaccines that are less reactive and more effective, I feel a lot more comfortable using it in dogs. In the past, if you had asked me 20 years ago, should I be using this, I'd be a little cautious just because we did see the higher rates of failure and more vaccine reactions. But now, I think if it fits where you're living and your dog, go ahead and get it.
I have a follow-up question on the tick control.
All right.
I've tried the spot-on stuff, and it doesn't seem to work on my dog. I think he's got a very strange coat. It's like two layers or something,
mm-hmm.
and it's hard to get down to his skin.
Yeah.
And then I've also tried the ones you... the pill form or whatever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he got sick on that. He kept throwing up.
Okay.
So I just have a collar on him, which pretty well works pretty much. We might have one, maybe two ticks a year.
And remember, the over-the-counter collars are very ineffective.
Okay.
The only collar, there's a couple of them that are out there that work that you can get through your veterinarian. And that one of them that we use is the Seresto collar. There is one that's called the Prevent Tick Collar that only gets ticks and does not get fleas. And if the dog were to ingest it, it can be quite toxic. So that was kind of in the past. We don't typically use that anymore. Checking out there, making sure that you are using something. If you bought the collar that comes in a tin, that's the one that seems to really do the job. But remember, ticks are very different than fleas. Ticks, when they climb on, just start feeding right away. They're not moving through the body. And so if they happen to be in an area where you maybe have a lower level of the chemical, they may not be getting a lot of it applied to them, their bodies, and it may take them a while to die. Versus fleas that run through the hair coat and are constantly picking up chemical and grooming it off themselves, and so they tend to die faster. So people will think this tick product isn't working, but you may only be getting like one or two ticks on your dog when you may be getting 100 if you didn't have something else on. So it doesn't mean that they totally failed, but I think that trying to find something that your dog will tolerate is really important for tick control.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. Lots of photos up there, great photos of our dogs. Jill, though, sent one of her dog's ear. She says, my dog shakes his head frequently, has caused trauma to the tips of her ears. She's a Doberman with outcropped ears. Our vet is tested for infections and mites, both negative. We have an antiseptic cream from the vet, and I also put udder balm on the wound. I also bought a no-flap ear wrap, which she hates. And makes her shake her head all the more,
yeah.
But keeps the ears safe anyway. One ear just won't heal, and she's got a great shot of the ear.
Yeah, yeah. You know, one thing, a couple of things. One, I see the, unless this is a, like, just a photographic illusion, most Dobermans are going to be black and tan. And if you look at that, that's more of a silver and very light tan instead of, like, that red color. And those, that particular line, the blue Dobies, are very prone to a lot of skin problems. But one thing that I'm curious about is, why is your dog shaking its head in the first place? Is there something that's bothering your dog that needs to be addressed? Like, does your dog have underlying allergies or some type of ear disease that is making your dog itchy? And so that would be probably my number one thing, is find out why your dog is doing that kind of head shaking enough to be able to traumatize it. And usually when dogs are head shaking, they don't present with a scab on their ear. Most trauma, they end up breaking a blood vessel inside the ear flap, and they get something called an oral hematoma, a blood pocket between the cartilage and the skin. This may, for something like this, it may, what I'm curious about is this something like something called vasculitis, where you end up, because the ears have such tiny blood vessels that go right to the end, if you've got like little microscopic you know, immune complexes depositing there, it can set up an immune problem. And this may be something that they, if your vet is not comfortable with diagnosing this, getting a visit with a dermatologist to have a look at it, because it sure doesn't look like this typical self-trauma that I see. I'm really worried that there may be something else going on.
I've got to tell a story about a head-shaking dog. St. Bernard, I was in my dentist's office, Bill Thompson, at the time, and their St. Bernard was shaking its head. And he said, would you mind helping me? And so I got up out of the dentist chair and went outside. He held the dog's mouth open, and I looked inside, and the dog had bitten down on a stick, and the stick had broken off between the upper part of his teeth. Mm-hmm. And so it was caught in there. So he went back into the his office and got the pliers that he uses to pull teeth, and took the
got the stick out.
I held the mouth open. He got the stick out.
Wow. And you know, and we do see dogs shake their head for other reasons too, besides ear disease. And thank you for bringing that up. Dental disease. And this is the very last day of Pet Dental Health Month. So you know, making sure that your dog and cats have those pearly whites, and maybe that would be something to be looking into as well, as having that mouth looked at.
And Bill and his wife Joanne retired to Manitowoc, and he just passed away last a week or so ago at the age of 92.
Those great memories and your experience as a veterinary technician.
Oh, Bill, a great guy. Let's go to Connie in Portage next. Hi, Connie. Thanks for calling.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a corgi, and he was diagnosed 3 weeks ago. He's only 6 years old, as a diabetic. When we took him in, he had a blood sugar of 450. So they put him on insulin 9 units twice a day. So yesterday, 3 weeks later, I take him back. He's still 345. So they increased it to 10 units twice a day. Well, then I went to play euchre, and everybody's telling me my dog is going to go blind. He's going to have kidney problems and die within 6 months. And I am so upset, so I wanted to know what the doctor thought.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, uncontrolled diabetes definitely can, you know, result in the dog becoming very ill and result in them developing cataracts and having other things going on. But I think that if your dog is feeling good, then regulating a dog that's a diabetic is one of these time-consuming type things. And what we typically have to do, though, because every dog's a little bit different as to how they handle their insulin, is after they've been on their insulin for 2-3 weeks, we usually need to do what's called a glucose curve, meaning, and this would be something that many owners learn to do at home. There's a home glucose unit that they sell for pets.
It's not that. I just got that.
You did. Good,
yes.
Good.
He and wants to put him on the curve.
Yes. And so what you learn to do is every 2 hours you take a blood sugar measurement, and it just takes a very, very tiny amount of blood, similar to what we would get from one of our finger pricks, except we typically use one of the ear margin veins. And we you have that measured so that we can see when the insulin is reaching its peak effect, meaning when the blood sugar drops to the lowest level. And that way we can see, okay, even at the lowest level, your dog's insulin or glucose is still too high. We need to go up a little bit. But your vet's doing it just perfectly. We usually start at a low dose and very slowly ramp up, because if you go too fast and start raising that insulin level, especially based on just a single blood sugar measurement, the problem you run into is that they can become hypoglycemic, and that can be a life-threatening problem as well. So I always recommend that owners of dogs that are diabetic have a bottle of corn syrup with them, or at home, so that Perfect.
Yeah.
It sounds like you're doing everything the right way, and it's just a matter of being patient. And I tell you what, your bridge club needs to keep their nose out of your dog's health, and quit making you scared, because I have right now I'm working with a diabetic pug who is 12 and a half, almost 13. I mean, we see diabetics that are well-managed, living for years and years and years. So.
Oh, good. Oh, I'm so happy. My husband was just sick when I came home and told him.
Oh,
You can't always trust a euchre player.
No, but I think it sounds like your vet is doing everything perfectly, and it's going to be several weeks before you hit on the right dose, and even then, it may change. That little pug that I just mentioned, all of a sudden, her insulin needs went up, and we're like, what's going on? She had a urinary tract infection, and that was changing her insulin needs. We cleared up her urinary tract infection, and it dropped her insulin back to the level that it was under control. So sometimes when we see a dog get out of control, we look for things like that. So,
well, I'm an old RN, so I can take care of all that, but I cannot prick his ear. If he cried, I think I'd faint.
Oh. And sometimes we have to do that, but that's, if you're not too far away, it's not that big a deal. But there are lots of YouTube's videos out there on how to do home blood glucose monitoring in dogs and cats, and it really is quite easy, especially if you make it a fun experience for the dog. Like I recommend these things that are called lickety sticks. They look like a roll-on deodorant that has like a beef-flavored material in it that's very low in calories but extremely tasty. So it's not going to affect your dog's blood sugar at all. But teaching your dog that I touch your ear and you get to lick on this. I touch your ear, you lick on this. And then I prick your ear, you lick on that. So they're like getting distracted, and they think that that's absolutely wonderful. So look into something like that.
Yeah.
Well, with his shots, I use Effleurage, like you do when you're pregnant,
Yeah.
I just pinch him, and he never knows he's getting the insulin shot.
Yep. And and that works just the same way for doing the ears as well. So, okay.
There you go.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much for calling. And if you still have trouble, get your husband to do it.
Yeah.
Get him to do it. Darlene in Duluth, Minnesota, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a dog who's going to be 15 years old in a couple of months, and she's always been very healthy. But all of a sudden now she's developed something called vertigo, and I didn't realize dogs could get something like this, and I don't really know anything about it. She had one attack on the 4th of January and another one the 2nd of February, or February 19th. And I don't know if these attacks increase or if it kills the dog or just what exactly happens.
Well, there's a couple of things that need to be looked into. Very common age-related problem that we see in dogs, in fact, we even call it old dog vestibular disease, is where at acute in onset, they just suddenly feel like they're on the tilt-a-whirl. Their eyes are flicking back and forth. They may be nauseated. They can't walk. With supportive care, these dogs get better. Sometimes they'll have a residual head tilt, a little bit of a head tilt, especially if they're excited, but it can happen again. And it's not, but, you know, it's usually, many dogs, it's a one-time deal, and then they would have it again. But there's other things that can affect the vestibular system as well. Things like middle ear infections, brain tumors, brain infections. And so it's important to go through a very thorough, systematic physical and neurologic exam to try to determine, is this a problem in the brain or is this a problem that is outside the brain, which would put it more in the, is this a middle ear cavity problem or is this just this idiopathic old dog vestibular disease? Mm-hmm. And so if you're concerned, getting a second opinion from a veterinary neurologist may be in order. Every veterinarian is trained in how to do a neurologic exam and should be able to identify central vestibular disease from peripheral vestibular disease and let you know whether this is something that you just have to ride out and your dog's going to be back to normal or not. But it is really tough to watch these dogs over those few days that they can't walk and they're
loopy.
You know, yeah.
There we go. All right.
The attack lasted for about 5 to 6 hours, and by the time I was able to get her into the vet, she was fine again.
Yeah, and that's typically not like old dog vestibular disease. They usually last for days. And so I'm really worried. Is your dog having some type of a weird seizure disorder if it's just lasting for a few hours and then comes out of it? So that would make me be thinking that there may be something going on centrally. And so very strange presentation. And I know that if I had a dog like this coming in to see me at my clinic, I'd be walking down the hall to ask for a neurologic consult because we've got some great neurologists at the vet school that are able to, you know, walk through the patient and try to figure out what the best attack to try to get under control.
Yeah, there we go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Thinking your pet's health here on the Ideas Network with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us. Going back to the Facebook page for a minute, Sandy, looking at a regal-looking dog here from Annika. This looks, is from Facebook.
It looks like a Belgian Shepherd to me.
Yeah,
beautiful.
Yeah. She wonders what kind of essential oils are best for treating dogs with flea and ticks or kinds of recommended earth-friendly, non-toxic alternatives.
None. Okay. What? I'm sorry. I really, looking at flea research, there's a lot of hooey out there. And people end up having their dogs getting exposed to fleas and ticks and are sorry for it. And just because it's natural doesn't mean it's safe. I just, you know, I tell my students, you know, you wouldn't think about giving your dog arsenic, even though it's a natural product. But, you know, it's still, it could kill them. So many of these oils like D-L-limonene and so on like that, have been associated with toxicities. They're very poorly effective. And unfortunately, we're in a place living here in Wisconsin where we really need to, you know, use the products that we know are effective. So I'm sorry I can't help you.
We've got, a nice photo from Sarah, who wonders, my cats do this too, stare at the ceiling and the corners of rooms.
Oh, you know, and I was a week ago, I took a vacation and I stayed in Milwaukee in my daughter's historic Third Ward apartment. It was lovely and babysat their dog and cat. And her cat freaked me out because he would do this. He would just stare at things on the wall. And when I really got up and looked, it was a minuscule bug that was way up there that I didn't even see. And then there was another time where I'm working on my iPad and a light, the sun was catching it and he was staring at the light reflecting off the ceiling. And yet every time I would turn around, I would put the iPad down and he'd still be staring. And it took me a while to figure out what it was. So I wish I could tell you what your cat's staring at, but they being a predator, they probably are seeing, they maybe saw something move, a light fleck or something like that, but I don't know.
Sarah's kitty has got the longest tail I have
Look at that. It goes right.
Hairy,
yes.
Long black tail.
Yep. That would be a good dust mop.
There we go. Vicki in Mount Horeb, thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you. I have a 15-year-old Sheltie, and she's just a wonderful dog. She did have some heart issues at age 12, but medication has controlled it beautifully. But she is on furosemide, and just every once in a while, periodically, we get these bouts of diarrhea. And it's not diarrhea where she's, you know, going all the time and can't control it, but when she goes, it's diarrhea. And, you know, we've tried hamburger and rice, as our vet suggested and such, but she also tends to go off feed during these times, I've noticed, and it really doesn't seem to matter. It clears up by itself in a couple of days anyway, but I'm just wondering, you know, is there, when I see it initially, is there anything I could give her to stop it right away?
Yeah, is there any mucus in the stool? Sorry, people eating lunch. Is
no.
it any mucusy type material or?
Not once in a while.
Okay.
Perhaps. It's not a regular thing.
Okay, and no urgency. It's just.
Well, sometimes, but you know, she knows she needs to go out, and she's really good about that.
Okay. Does she strain? Does she strain after she goes to the bathroom?
Not after, but she will during.
During. Okay.
Diarrhea, yeah.
Okay.
But then it'll clear up after just, you know, a couple, 3 days.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's so many things that can cause this. And what the questions I was asking you is I'm trying to figure out, is this small bowel diarrhea or large bowel diarrhea? Because we tend to treat them and go about diagnostics a little bit differently. And so, you know, large bowel diarrhea, they tend to have blood and mucus, tends to be associated with smaller volumes, more frequent, some straining. Large bowel, they may be able to, you know, just go out and have, you know, liquid or soft stool, but there usually is no mucus or blood and no straining associated with it because the colon isn't irritated. And we treat both of them a little bit differently. And I think the diet change, wonderful. I mean, going on a bland diet, I think, would be appropriate. The other thing that we will sometimes add in to help these dogs is a drug called metronidazole or Flagyl. Some dogs do very well on that because it has some anti-inflammatories effect and antibacterial effect on the gut. And so sometimes we'll go ahead and use that. I would also be looking at, if this has become a recurrent problem for your dog, just because your dog is 15 doesn't mean that it may not have internal parasites. And I'd be looking at going through a therapeutic deworming program for whipworms and Giardia, which are two fairly common parasites that we have in this area. And the drug that we use is something called fenbendazole, and you have to use it daily for 5 days. And that would be another thing that I think would be indicated just to kind of get certain things off the table. Besides checking a stool sample, also just going through this, because sometimes we don't see these parasites on a normal fecal evaluation.
Could I also mention, you know, she's on a little dose of furosemide. She takes like a half a pill morning and night because of the heart issue. And our vet has thought that perhaps because furosemide is pulling, moisture from that, just once in a while, it's causing these loose stools.
I don't think so, unless it's affecting her potassium level, and that can sometimes affect gut motility, which can cause diarrhea. So anytime we have an animal on heart drugs, we very carefully monitor electrolytes. And so if you have not been in for lab work recently, this would be something that would be not a bad idea to get that potassium level checked to make sure it's normal, because that can affect the gut and can affect, make them nauseated, can you know, they may have looser stools just because the motility of the gut is slower.
There we go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it very much. We have Mariah in Milwaukee up next. Mariah, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was calling because I have an 11-year-old boxer that we found a cancerous tumor on him and had it removed and found out that it was a mast cell tumor.
Mm-hmm.
And they ended up removing actually three, like two other small ones that we didn't see.
Yeah.
And they
said that it was a stage 2 cancer and recommended we do chemotherapy and radiation for it. But since he's 11 years old, we don't want to have to do invasive sort of person.
And
we don't know. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say a couple of things that we do when we have dogs with mast cell tumors where it may have been incompletely resected and the owner is not wanting to pursue any other therapeutic work with either chemotherapy or radiation is to make sure, because the mast cells release certain chemicals in the little granules that are in them, because mast cells are involved with kind of the allergic reaction in the body. Excuse me. We can sometimes see the stomach get upset. So we will often put these dogs on gastroprotectant agents like antacids, like omeprazole, or, you know, Prilosec is one of them that you can get over the counter. Excuse me. But that would be something that may be able to give your dog some comfort, especially if they are, you know, seeing some GI distress.
Okay.
All right. But usually mast cell tumors themselves are not going to be painful unless they're in a location like on a toe or in an area that is going to be causing chronic irritation.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have another photo from Christy of her little, what is that? Anyway, her little puppy, white cutest thing ever.
Oh, my goodness. I think that's either a little Maltese or, I'm not sure, a Bichon that's shaved a little funny.
Looks pretty alert and pretty darn cute.
And no tear staining. Look at that. So nice white hair coat.
She says Seresto. I think she likes Seresto. Covers for 8 months?
Yes, it does. That's the flea and tick collar that I was talking about earlier. And if you've got a dog that's spending a lot of time swimming, it will lose some of its efficacy, and you have to replace it every 5.
All right, there we go. Well, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, she's going to be with us right up till 12:30 today. And so you can join in, 800-642-1234. Send us your photos on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'll be back right after this look at the news. We're taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us. Every one of our phone lines filled right now. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Bill in Madison, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I have a 10.5-year-old male standard poodle Australian Shepherd cross that we adopted about 5 years ago and has Addison's. The vet recommended at one point, she never read an article on this, to work him up to about a tablespoon of salt with each feeding, and he responded immediately. He was down to 35 pounds when we got him, and we got him up to 55, and recently he's crashed. And so I've started giving him fluids, half a liter every other day.
Yeah.
And an injectable, I forget the name of it, that the vet recommended. It's expensive.
Well, what Addison's disease is it can be a life-threatening problem. Obviously, as you've been finding out with your dog, it's very common in poodles. So unfortunately, your mixed breed dog inherited the poodle side of their genetics. And what it is low functioning adrenal glands. And the adrenal glands have two functions in the body. One of them is to control electrolyte levels, sodium and potassium. And so these dogs will come in, and if we get blood work done on them, we'll see usually their sodium level is low and their potassium level can be high. And as a result, with their potassium level being high, that can affect the heart, and it can be fatal for them. And so they have to be on something that will help balance that out. And that's what that injectable drug is that your veterinarian has your dog on right now, that will help with keeping those electrolytes normal. Giving salt, no, that was not probably in the dog's best interest, because the potassium is what is going to typically kill the dog. And then the other thing that the adrenal glands do is they make all the hormones that we need, the chemicals for our body that we need for handling stress. And so they make something called cortisol. And so whenever we're stressed, we produce cortisol. And if you don't have that, then you can't handle stressful situations. And most of these, we'll see animals coming in, we call it the great imposter, because some dogs will come in with kind of chronic intermittent gastrointestinal signs, chronic intermittent weakness, just, you know, not doing right, maybe not wanting to eat. And it is something that once it's diagnosed, we typically have to treat with physiological doses of steroids, usually prednisone, at very low levels, just to make up for what the body isn't producing. And so we're not giving it to the level where we're going to be seeing side effects. And then they need to be on a drug that's going to help control those electrolytes. And it's usually an injectable drug that we use. And it's you know, it's something that needs a lot of monitoring back and forth, a lot of blood work. It's a very hands-on disease to be able to keep under control. But dogs with it, especially with an owner that's very good at watching and being able to anticipate stressful situations and maybe increasing the dose of steroids for a day or two, usually go on to live a very normal life. But it does take becoming very good friends with your veterinarian.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah, the his name is Gray Bear, and he is just such a sweetheart. When I give him fluids, he'll come to the area with a rug that I've got laid out, and he'll just lay down and let me poke him. It bothers me more than it does him. He just lays there.
It probably is making him feel a little bit better to get rehydrated, but if you don't have him on physiologic doses of steroids, that would be another thing to talk to your veterinarian about. Yeah,
good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Want to give Sue in Milwaukee a chance to join in with us. Sue, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry and Dr. Sandy. I guess I feel a little embarrassed after listening to your last caller about calling about my concern, but I do have a little five-year-old mixed breed dog, and he has gigantic eye goobers that come out of his eyes every single day. He was on antibiotics for something else, I can't remember, a few years ago, and it all cleared up. And now over time, we're kind of back to where we are.
Yeah.
They're large and they're gross and they're daily.
Yeah. Well, you know, tears, when dogs, what dogs make, the tears are actually made up of two parts. A mucoid type material, which is like the sleepery type material that we have in the corners of our eyes when we wake up in the morning. And then they also produce a liquid part of the tears, which keeps, you know, the eyes moister. And so there's actually those two parts. And sometimes when I have a dog that's producing a lot of goo, we see the fact that they may or not producing enough tears, and they may not have enough of the liquid portion of their tears, and may need to be treated for that. And this is something that you can have tested very simply. It's called a Schirmer tear test. It's little calibrated pieces of filter paper that have a dye impregnated in it, and it just gets put between the third eyelid and the lower eyelid, and it sucks up the tears for a minute, and we kind of know what the normal values are for dogs. So that would be one thing that I would be looking at. I'd also be looking to see, does your dog have any indication of any inflammatory changes in the eyes? And sometimes we'll see dogs with conjunctivitis secondary to allergies that will get really gunky eyes, and that may mean putting some numbing drops in the eye and actually having a look behind the third eyelid to see, do we have indication of something called follicular conjunctivitis? So looking for things like that. And then I'd also be looking for things outside the eyeball that could be bothering the eye. making them tear more, which is also going to make more mucus, such as hair rubbing on the eyes, where it can accumulate on the face. And so if your dog has a hairy face, like a poodle or a shih tzu, sometimes keeping that hair trimmed away from the eyes is going to make make that stuff not build up quite as quickly. It's going to be able to roll off the dog's face rather than build up and have you have to clean it up in the morning. So I would not be looking at this as just cosmetic until you've ruled out everything else.
All right.
Well, we had talked to our vet about it, and he didn't seem too concerned. I think he thought it was more normal, but mm-hmm. not another dog, and there's just no comparison.
Yeah, and so it may or may not be normal. Some dogs just produce more, you know, morning eye goo that you have to clean, but, typically there is an underlying reason, and it's just a matter of trying to, get to the bottom of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there we go, Sue. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Mark in Bayfield, your turn now. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You earlier in the show, you were talking about dangerous leashes. Well, my two dogs, Boris and Ella, were playing bitey face in our living room one night, and they were wearing their collars, and Boris has got his mouth on Ella's collar all the way hooked over his back teeth, and Ella did some ninja move to get out of it and ended up twisting it one time over and was suddenly being strangled.
Oh, my goodness.
And I told my wife, get us scissors, and because the collar she was wearing wasn't even one with a releasable clip on it. It was one of these that you slip over her head and then it tightens when you add a leash. We'll never have one of those again. Well, now we have a rule at our house that the minute they come in from a walk, their collars come off, too, because if they're going to play when we're not home, we don't want to come home to one of them with a broken jaw and the other one, suffocated.
Yeah,
and that can happen. And, we've seen this with choked collars where I've had dogs get their toenail caught through the ring of end of a choke collar that's been left on, and and every time they move their leg to try to get it off, they're choking themselves. I mean, I think that this would be one of the reasons why having a dog that's microchipped, at least they have some form of ID. If you have a dog that plays like that, and I don't leave collars on my dogs for exactly the same reason, because being bulldogs, they like to do, like you called, the bitey face, where they've just got their mouths wide open and they're not hurting each other, but they just like to kind of play like that, and it could become dangerous if they get their lower jaw caught on something. So thank you very much for that warning.
Oh, I have one last thing to add. Why does my dog like to eat bark? For the roughage. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah!
The roughage.
Okay. Ha, ha, ha.
Rough.
I'll remember that one, yes.
Oh, well, what about Lisa? Let's go to her in Madison. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, I know you've talked about Apoquel. Is there a vaccine now for allergies?
There is, and it's given the name Cytopoint. And it's an injectable that's done in your vet office, and it lasts for anywhere from 4 to 8 weeks. And when it stops working, and that's when you have to go in for another injection. And so there's no way of knowing how long it lasts for your particular dog until you've actually gone through a little trial with it. What it is it's an injectable, almost like a vaccine that targets and neutralizes one of the key ingredients in itching, and it's called interleukin-31. And it's, I'm giving you more information than you need, but it's a very scientific approach to dealing with itch. And dogs that are not responding to Apoquel, or owners that have a hard time remembering to give pills. Apoquel is the once-a-day anti-itch medication that's very safe, not a steroid, that, again, is directed right at the receptors for some of the itching. They do very well on this, and it begins working in about a day. So it's. I think that if your veterinarian has it, and you can't pill your dog doesn't tolerate or doesn't respond well to Apoquel, this would be a wonderful alternative to try.
Okay. Cytopel?
Cytopoint. C-Y-T-O, and then the word point.
Is it widely used yet?
It's been used. We've been using it at the vet school for a couple of years now. It is just been released to the general market in the last Probably 3 or 4 months.
Okay.
So, but we've had very good experiences with it at the vet school with our dermatology department.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling. Chris in Dubuque, Iowa, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, my question is also about Apoquil. I have an American Bulldog, and she just chews her feet terribly. And the Apoquil works good, but I just kind of wondering, is that, I heard that she said that it's not a steroid.
It isn't?
It isn't a steroid.
No, it is not a steroid, right? Uh-huh.
What's the long-term effect of that stuff?
We've had dogs on it long-term now since it's been on the market for, 2-3 years, because we were using it before it actually became readily available for veterinarians to use, and we've had no long-term consequences with it. I think that if your dog has seasonal allergies, it's always worthwhile to try weaning your dog off of it, and then remember when you need to start it back up again. The initial 2 weeks of using that drug requires them to be on it twice a day, and then after 2 weeks, you drop down to once a day. So anytime you stop the medication, you do have to go back and do that again. But we've seen dogs on it for a long, long time and had virtually no side effects or reactions.
Is there any other thing? This Cytopoint, I heard you. Do you favor one or the other?
I think the Cytopoint's going to be a little more expensive, probably depending on the size of your dog, about double the cost of the oral medication. And so I typically don't jump to using that right away. But I think that if we have an owner that has a pet that doesn't like to be pilled, or for some reason is one of the oddball ones that can't tolerate it, or they just prefer to, you know, not have to worry about day-to-day medication because they're not very compliant, kind of like me. Sorry, I'm always forgetting to give my dog some medications. My husband's like, "Did you treat their ears?" You know, so so I'm as guilty as the next person, and so this is a way you can kind of have it done and forget about it.
Is there other than diet? I mean, can change. We've tried every combination of or diet that you can think of, and I don't know.
Food allergies only account for probably about 10 to 15% of the allergy cases that we see. Most of them are environmental. And so I think the big things to think about when we're dealing with dogs with allergies are making sure that you are keeping secondary infections under control. And when we've got dogs that are licking and chewing at their feet, we often will get secondary yeast infections and bacterial infections. And so we recommend routinely bathing with an antibacterial, antifungal shampoo. It would be a prescription shampoo, at least, you know, the feet at least 3 times a week, to try to keep things under control. And then, you know, sometimes we can even use a steroid spray on really bad days just on the feet. But remember, long-term use with steroids can predispose them to infections and thin the skin and so on. So we don't want to use them as our sole treatment. Just doing something as simple as washing your dog's feet when they come in, damp mopping them, can be enough to keep some of the allergens and things under control. And making sure that you're washing your dog's bedding frequently. I usually say during allergy season, at least weekly, because they're coming in and that, you know, is a big source of allergens that they are laying on, because, you know, their body's been there just shedding hair and anything they've carried in from the outside.
I see.
All right.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Chris. Appreciate the call. Lisa in Amberg, your turn. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I don't know if you have an answer for me or not, but I have dairy goats. And last spring, they were just tormented with mosquitoes. And I need to put something on them to protect them from the mosquitoes.
Oh.
But I have to be sure that it doesn't contaminate the milk, and
boy,
I don't know what to use.
I would be contacting a large animal veterinarian, because this would be something that I am really, I've never treated goats for with mosquito repellents or anything like that. But just thinking, if you're looking for something kind of more holistic. You can put up bat houses. You can put up a Martin house, you know, things like that that would encourage species that will eat the mosquitoes, looking for the source of where the mosquitoes are coming from and perhaps dealing with that directly. But I'd be thinking contacting extension vets or somebody just to be able to get something, because boy, the stuff that I use in dogs and cats, we don't have to worry about humans.
They're right. Yeah, right. Absolutely. So good luck, Lisa. Thanks for calling. And Jim in Madison, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Oh, thanks for taking it. I got what we call a Cocker Shepherd, part Cocker and part Australian. He blew his ACL out in his rear right leg, I guess, back in November. I took him to the vet, got the estimate. I even called the UW Vet Hospital to get a countering offer, and it was a lot more expensive to have done there. I've been low on the budget. I didn't do the surgery, which was like basically the, I guess, drill into the bone and stitch it up with fishing line. I never did it. I kept the dog pretty mellow as I could. And he seems to be walking around on all four legs. My vet said that dogs don't heal on their own. They're not like humans, that you just can't keep them mellow, and that they don't really do a repair on the ACL in a dog, whereas in a human they can repair the ACL knee and they put them on crutches and humans rest. He hasn't probably done the best job resting. I've kept him mellow, but he's doing stairs and chasing crows and mostly all on all fours. And once in a while, he goes up and pulls that rear leg up.
Yeah.
When you're comparing surgeries as one vet office to another, you also have to look at what type of surgery is being done. The typical surgery at the vet school that we do is something called TPLO, tibial planing leveling osteopathy. I don't know, but the whole TPLO, okay? But it's a more reliable type of surgery than the fishing line type of surgery that you are talking about. I don't know when we've actually done that type of surgery at the vet school in years. So it's there are different types of surgery, and of course, when you're looking at putting in joint implants and things like that, then that's going to add to the cost. But things that you can do for your dog if surgery is not an option. Number one is get the weight off your dog. If they are at all fat or carrying extra weight, make sure that you get them on a diet, because over half these dogs within a year will rupture the other one. And it's a given. So keep the weight off of them, making sure that your dog is on some types of joint supplements, glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate, avocado unsulfonopiable. There's a whole host of things that are out there. Every vet kind of has their favorite one. The one that I recommend is a drug called Dazoquin. You can get it online. You can get it through your veterinarian. And then they do make for dogs some of the kind of external joint support things that may help. Now, the issue with those are they have to be custom made, because every dog is different. Dogs' knees are very different than ours, the way they're configured. And so some dogs don't tolerate them. They get some wear and things that can be really bothersome. But that might be something to be looking into, that would be an alternative that would give your dog the external support it would need to keep that knee more comfortable. Because without treatment, eventually your dog's going to end up with pretty marked arthritis in that knee, and it's going to impair their movement and happiness in life down the road.
Yeah, there we go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. Sandy, we have some here in this last minute or so, we've got some wonderful photos. Doug sent one, his favorite picture of Bailey. What?
And, it's really nice to see a dog with a big chew in his mouth, because this is Dental Health Month and we want dogs to be on things that have the Veterinary Oral Health Council seal of approval. So making sure that you see that little seal of approval on those products that you're buying to make sure that your dog's teeth are going to be staying clean. But that's great. That thing is bigger than the dog. Yeah.
Julie sent a nice photo of her cat. There's lots of nice photos up there, and I hope you'll go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show and take a look at everybody's favorite photo of their pet. Sandy, thank you so much.
You are welcome.
She'll be back on March 28th. We'll do this all over again. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Tomorrow we'll talk about bats and bat houses at 11:45. We'll take a look at bird watching. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network.